Some history shows merely scratch the surface.
It's one small step for man.
We go a little deeper.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
This is Deep Into History. How deep do you want to go?
Deep Into History is independent and proudly listener-supported. Consider this a foreword. During this long journey you and I have embarked upon through the show, the podcast industry has gone through many changes. I am humbled that after 5 years, Deep Into History has gone from a tiny indie show to a platform with a powerful voice, not only through my tales, but on social media. Hard work does pay off, and I hope that soon I will be able to support myself modestly and do nothing but research, write, and record. In order to achieve this goal, in the context of the trends of the industry, I need to expand my audience so I can truly compete with mainstream networks that have teams of people working to write and produce each episode. Adapting to these new circumstances has been a struggle, as long narrative shows like mine are becoming a thing of the past, as the model for hit shows is structured around advertising, with a length that is meant to reflect the average commute time to work in a city. As you know, our experiences often take that long just to set the scene, so that you have the context to go beyond what historical figures did and understand why they did what they did. That combined with providing cultural context, social norms, my narrative flow, and my storytelling ability allows history to come to life in your mind in a unique way, so that you feel its resonance and can access that knowledge with the ease of remembering a scene from a favorite movie. Emotional investment, which I strive to weave into every script I write, the essence of Deep Into History success. I'm not seeking to change that, yet the realities of the industry, especially now when I'm able to compete at the top tier, require the show to adapt. The tale you're about to experience is the first of what I'm sure will be many attempts to change my game so I can continue to change the game. Your financial support has given me the opportunity to work with the renowned podcast producer York Campbell to deliver you the highest quality sound with York's unique flair for mixing in music and effects, along with his professional advice on other changes and strategies so that Deep Into History can be consistently in your feeds in the coming year and take its rightful place at the top of the charts as an elite veteran of the podcast wars, if you will. So, please enjoy this trip back to my second tale with the script tweaked and for the first time professionally remixed and produced by a master of the craft. Consider that as we go forward. And with that said, this forward comes to an end.
This is Deep Into History, and here's your host,
Arjun Hundle. This is the tale of a battle that spelled the beginning of the end of a war that lasted 100 years, a battle that, though consequential at the time, had cultural consequences that affect us to this very day, a struggle so epic that it inspired the immortal bard himself. We'll encounter knights in gleaming armor, a mad king, a truly uncivil civil war, and a man who would set the standard of greatness by which all subsequent English monarchs would be judged. So take a deep breath. Let it out slowly. Put some smoke in the air if you choose. And come dream with me as we go deep into the year 1415 in the Common Era and cry havoc, let loose the dogs of war as we experience the Battle of Agincourt.
Welcome to the day chivalry died.
We could discuss the root causes of the Hundred Years' War for hours. I'm going to condense it into a nice little nutshell for you so we don't get bogged down in names and too many dates. Said nutshell will contain just enough so that you can contextualize the events leading to the battle. I will drop one name on you though, Eleanor of Aquitaine. She should be familiar to you. She is one of the greatest and most inspiring women in medieval history. She was noble, strong, powerful, beautiful, and every inch what you'd imagine a great queen to be. When Eleanor married the King of England, she brought with her a colossal dowry in the form of vast lands in France. In fact, after her marriage, the English throne controlled more than half of the modern country. Over the years, there were many marriages between the royal families of France and England. Fast forward a century or so, the King of France dies. And because of these intermarriages, you have an English king with a better claim to the French throne than anyone else. See the problem? The French don't want to be ruled by a foreign monarch, so they install their own candidate. England can't tolerate the insult, so war is declared. And so begins what we call the Hundred Years' War. It actually lasted 116 years, but that doesn't have the same ring to it, does it? What unfold are decades of fighting, with the tides of war going back and forth between the rivals. there has been constant combat all over France. And even where they aren't major battles, there is constant raiding and pillaging. The French peasantry suffer so much and so consistently that, where they construct vast cave networks that they can hide in when the enemy is spotted, the remnants of which can still be seen today. It is an extremely bloody conflict. There are heroes on both sides. It is a time of knights and the height of the age of chivalry. And France is the very heartland of that way of life. Every knight swears to obey and live by the chivalric code, or the six vows. They are fair play, never attack an unarmed foe. Nobility, obey the law, respect women, protect the innocent. Valor, exhibit courage in everything, avenge the wronged, defend the weak and innocent. Honor, always keep your word, avoid deception, respect life. Courtesy, exhibit manners, be polite. Loyalty, to God, the king, your country, and the code. Upon hearing it, it sounds like a code everyone should live by. The problem is that most knights only paid lip service to it. In fact, obeying the code was something of a rarity. There were a few true knights and knightly orders, but in essence, knights functioned as the enforcers of feudalism, which itself was in essence a protection racket. Peasants worked the land, craftsmen created tools, and they paid a large portion of what they produced to their local lord in exchange for the lord's protection against foreign invaders, or more often than not, neighboring lords. The lords would pay a portion of what they received to their counts, counts to dukes, and dukes to the king. Just like not paying your taxes today is considered a major crime by your government, in the High Middle Ages, not paying your due was akin to a declaration of war. You paid or you died. That's how order was maintained in a feudal monarchy. Each lord kept a retinue of knights. In modern times, there is a tendency to think of them in shining armor on quest to rescue damsels in distress or seeking out the Holy Grail. Even shows like Game of Thrones or Nightfall do not quite show what knights actually were. They were quite simply murder machines, men bred to war since boyhood. The sons of knights and nobles would start as pages as young as 6 years old, where they learned the chivalric code. After, they would become squires to a knight, where they would learn the care and cleaning of armor and weapons. They would train every day with other squires and receive instruction from their knights. Once a squire was deemed trained and had proven himself in some way, be it loyal service, bravery in battle, or excelling on a tourney field, they would receive the word, spend the night in prayer and contemplation. In the morning, they would take a knee before their knight and swear to uphold the chivalric code. Then the knight would slap him hard across the face and say,
"May that be the last blow you take. That goes unanswered."
The squire would rise a knight, the first rung on the ladder of nobility. All knights strive for advancement to the next rung, to become landed knights, with a keep and lands of their own to govern. There was only one way to get there fast, and it was to build a reputation as a warrior. In peace times, this was done in melees and jousting tournaments. But this is the Hundred Years' War, and France is a literal battlefield. If not against the English, then against each other. To gain a formidable reputation as a warrior, you needed to excel at one thing.
Killing.
I want to impress this upon you. In history, there have been vastly stronger armies than the armies of medieval Europe. But at no time, ever, or ever since, have you had armies where men were literal tanks in plate armor, riding ferocious armored horses, armed with the most brutal weapons mankind had yet come up with, wielded with such incredible expertise. Because if you weren't an expert, you died. There are battles between bands of knights where both sides were made up with men with individual kill counts in the hundreds. And yes, they kept score. Battle was all they knew. Killing was what they excelled at, and they loved war. Why? Well, war meant the possibility of not just gaining lands, but of capturing men of noble rank, whose families would pay huge ransoms for their safe return. Even low-ranking nobles could bring large sums of gold and silver, and if, just if, you could slaughter enough of their men-at-arms to capture someone of high rank, it was the medieval equivalent of winning the lottery. Wealth beyond imagining was in a knight's reach if his skills killed. As we approach the year 1415 Common Era, 100 years' war is in a state of ceasefire. And a very tenuous peace exists between England and France. You see, in the previous decades, the French had gone on a long and very successful series of military offenses. In fact, they had taken back most of their country. With the exception of the port of Calais in the north and a small province in the south, the English had been pushed out of France. The French may well have gone on for a final offensive and ended English power on the continent, but they had a problem. The French king, Charles VI, was quite literally insane. Called the Mad King for good reason. He had moments of sanity, but would spend the bulk of his time staring into a mirror, claiming he was made of glass.
"Look at me, and what do you see? I am a man made of glass."
He was so terrified that he would shatter that he had metal rods sewn into his clothing, saying it was the only way to keep his body together. The Mad King had a son, Charles VII, but the Dauphin, as the heir to the French throne was known, liked only two things, wine and sex workers. He was content to let the King's Council rule France and run the war as long as he had unlimited money for his constant debauchery. With weak central authority, the French nobility was split between two camps. One, led by the king's brother, Louis, the Duke of Orléans, were called the Armagnacs.
What?
The Armagnacs.
Okay, I get it.
The other faction was led by the king's cousin, John, Duke of Burgundy, called the Burgundians. The Armagnacs and Burgundians despised each other. While fighting the English, they would be in a state of cold war, always wary of each other, constantly plotting, scheming, and jockeying for position at court. In periods of peace, their disputes would sometimes erupt into full-blown civil war. There had been assassinations, murders, ambushes, raids, village massacres, and every imaginable atrocity committed by each side against the other. It was this constant infighting, coupled with the madness of the king, that forced France to make peace with England, because the more land that France won, the greater the tension over which faction would gain control of it. You may be wondering what was stopping one of the leaders of these factions from renouncing their loyalty to the Mad King and the pudgy Prince of Paris and seizing the throne for themselves. The answer to that question is a man who was something of a rarity in the time. The son of a commoner who rose to become Marshal of France. At a young age, due to his size and strength, he was enlisted to be a squire. Through excellence in training and surpassing bravery on the battlefield, he was knighted. He then proved to be invincible in tournaments, a jouster without peer. Once given command of a small band of men, he proved a nightmare for his foes on the battlefield because he was also a tactical genius. And in single combat, he was perhaps the deadliest warrior that France ever produced. A brilliant strategist, beloved by the people, and if not respected by the nobility, they definitely feared his wrath. He lived and breathed the chivalric code. A true knight who never broke an oath and was absolutely loyal to the king. Jean Lamarne, who rose to become Marshal Boucicault. As long as he stood by the king, no one dared make a move against the throne. Marshal Boucicault commanded the royal forces, and it was only fear of him that kept a full-blown civil war from breaking out in France. The Armagnacs and Burgundians continued their assassinations and plotting against each other. And as we approach 1415, both sides are preparing for the inevitable death of the Mad King, waiting, biding their time. France is a powder keg that just needed a spark to light its fuse. North, across the channel in England, the situation was slightly more stable. The crown had recently passed to its young king, Henry V. King Henry's father had usurped the throne, and as a result, England had gone through a bloody civil war and a near catastrophic revolt in Wales led by the Welsh hero, Owain Glyndwr. Since the age of 12, Henry had been at war. He lived his life in army camps and on battlefields. He was at home with common soldiers as he was with nobility and royalty. His men loved him because Henry V was no tourney knight. He was a warrior who excelled at his trade. He followed the chivalric code as much as practicality allowed and was also a devout Catholic who truly believed that God was on his side on all things. It was during the brutal guerrilla-style Welsh revolt that Henry saw the longbow used by the rebels to devastating effect. The Welsh longbowmen had perfected wielding their 6-foot bows in unison and at a tremendous rate of fire. experienced groups of archers could and did release withering waves of arrows, firing at rates as high as 10 arrows per minute, an unheard of speed. Henry had been raised with the tales of the great English victories at Crecy and Poitiers, where the longbow had played a decisive role. The Welsh, though, with their astronomical rate of fire, could shred lines of men-at-arms, even those wearing heavy plate armor, which gave him an idea. He sent an order from the Welsh front that banned all sports except archery and made it mandatory for all males to practice it on Sundays, as it took time to build the muscles required to continually draw a longbow with 120 pounds of resistance and even more to become accurate. Then Henry devised a strategy. England had 1/5 the population of France. They could never match the French with sheer numbers of men-at-arms or knights, so they needed an edge. He envisioned a campaign to take the French throne, which he saw as his birthright. And to achieve this, he needed to be able to defeat every French army they could muster on his march to Paris. So he restructured and reformed the English army. Archers would now make up 3/4 of his troops. The remainder would be men-at-arms, commoners garbed in chainmail, and armored knights fighting on foot. With this new order of battle, with the right terrain, he believed he could crush any French army sent against him. After subduing the revolt, he sent a call to every rebel Welsh archer, offering them a contract where they would sign up and receive a set wage for a year at a time. He extended this to all of England, and the nationwide contract system was born. He wanted and got full-time soldiers who, through constant drilling and practice together, became professional units. They would serve him all year, and at the end of the contract, they could choose to sign up again at higher wages for their experience. This type of contract is still used by militaries around the world. In 1413 Common Era, Henry's father dies and he ascends to the English throne. Becoming King Henry V, he wastes no time and implements all his plans. And thanks to his previous policies, there is now a colossal pool of competent archers available for service. Even though the bulk of his army came from the peasantry, recruiting and maintaining troops this way was very expensive. So he went to Parliament and informed them of the justice of his cause and his God-given mandate to seize the French throne. It was his. It was his destiny to unite the crowns and rule. Parliament voted to create a war tax that would give Henry a massive war chest. Even so, the costs were enormous. He had to train, house, equip, and feed large numbers of men and horses. He also had to construct a massive fleet to get his army across the English Channel. Henry was even forced to pawn the crown jewels to complete his preparations for his invasion of France. In addition to his archers and men-at-arms, Henry added a contingent of siege cannon to breach city walls. This would mark one of the first times that a northern European army would march with such a large number of gunpowder weapons. Because they were heavy, difficult to move, and were very expensive. Beginning in the spring of 1415, the army and fleet gathered at Southampton. Henry was careful to leave garrisons in Wales and on the Scottish border so that England was protected while the army was away. At the age of 25, King Henry V was going to lead a massive army of 12,000 men and nearly 20,000 horses across the Channel. His fleet had over 650 transport ships and would be escorted by 50 warships for protection. On August 11th, they set sail. Aware that through spies and turncoats, the French would know they were coming, as concealing the massive preparations would have been impossible anyway, he ensured that no one except a few trusted commanders knew where the fleet was headed. Rumors on the continent planted by Henry were that the English would follow the Atlantic coast and land in the far south of France. As we shall see, he needn't have bothered with the deception. The mutual suspicion and hatred between the factions in France and the total lack of leadership from the royal family had paralyzed their ability to react. King Henry had decided to attack where no one would expect him to. Instead of taking a few easy targets, like lightly defended towns in the interior, Henry had decided to take France's most heavily fortified and important port in Normandy, the bustling and rich town of Harfleur. With massive walls, a moat, heavily fortified gates, a large garrison, and tremendous natural defenses, this was no easy proposition. Yet he believed that with his heavy siege cannon, he could take the town in as little as 2 weeks, which if achieved would be a record speed for the time. His fleet crossed the English Channel, and to everyone's surprise, the landing was completely unopposed. The warships blockaded the harbor, and the army disembarked with ease. Within days of landing, Harfleur was fully surrounded and under siege. We can only imagine the deafening man-made thunder of the mass cannons opening fire on the massive battlements. Volley after volley of cannonballs, slowly reducing rock to dust. The siege of Harfleur continues after this. I hope you're enjoying Deep into History, and I thought I'd take a minute to ask you for your help. This show and I are at a critical juncture, for we are one and the same, and I could really use your financial support to keep us independent, ad-free, and thriving. Please go to patreon.com/deepintohistory, directly on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and subscribe today. You'll gain access to an ever-growing library of subscriber-exclusive episodes, earlier releases, and bonus content. And of course, you get to chat with me. That's patreon.com/deepintohistory. And to all my subscribers, I salute you and thank you from the center of my being. Now back to
The Day Chivalry Died.
August 17th, 1415, Common Era. Harfleur, Normandy, France. As soon as the English fleet was sighted, the commander of the French garrison sent messengers south to warn that they would soon be under siege and asking that a relief army be sent at once.
J'ai besoin d'aide.
The response from the capital was to send a supply column to the beleaguered town, with no military aid forthcoming. Yet after pleas for aid came from all over Normandy, the royal council relented and named as titular head of the relief army a noble trusted by all factions, Charles d'Albret, who was named Constable of France, a symbolic appointment for considerations of class. But the real commander was the true knight, Marshal Boucicault, who dispatched orders for all the forces the Burgundians and Armagnacs could muster to head to a staging area near Rouen in Normandy. Despite this, apart from the royal levies, troops only slowly trickled in. To combat this sluggish response, the Oriflamme was sent for. This was the war banner of France, in legend, Charlemagne's banner. It was a bright red silk banner with a golden sunburst carried into battle on a gilded lance. It was only removed from its home in the Abbey of Saint-Denis when there was a foreign army on French soil. Its presence meant that there would be no quarter given, and it was the duty of every Frenchman to take up arms. In practice, it meant that there would be a large battle, and after the long truce, the chivalry of France was itching for a fight, and the chance at glory and riches that lay on the battlefield. It proved to be a wise move. The Oriflamme had knights flocking to it. Even the opposing dukes could do little to stop their own men from wanting to fight. With the exception of the Duke of Burgundy and his immediate family, the flower of all of the chivalry of France was headed to Rouen. At Harfleur, the weather was extraordinarily hot, and men could not tolerate being in armor for long, so it became a matter for the siege cannon. Henry's artillery contingent was one of the first in history to have practiced firing at night. They could maintain operations in the pitch dark, so his siege cannons never stopped firing. It must have been incredibly unnerving for the besieged at Harfleur to be surrounded by the explosions of cannon fire and the thundering impacts from cannonballs hitting the walls 24 hours a day. As the supply column that the French had sent approached, it was first captured by the English. Then the garrison sallied forth from the town gates and recaptured it, taking inside some of the much-needed supplies. There were attempts at attacking the walls directly using siege ladders, but they were repulsed with great losses. Defenders fought heroically and held the walls against far greater numbers. The skill of the French knights in close combat was second to none. Thus the walls held, and weeks passed. Even though the English had brought supplies with them, Henry had not expected the siege to last so long. In need of more food, he sent parties to forage for shellfish in the nearby salt marshes. Perhaps it was those crayfish, or the proximity of so many men, horses, and mosquitoes. During the fourth week of the siege, the dreaded bloody flux appeared in the English lines. Dysentery, The nightmare of every medieval army had arrived in force. It caused horrible stomach pain, punctuated by bouts of blood-laden diarrhea. More likely than not, the unusual heat, coupled with the foul weather from all the men and animals defecating in a relatively small area, greatly worsened the effects. It soon spread throughout the army, and according to some reports, the town of Harfleur as well. Its effects ravaging, soon thousands were sick. And though most who got the illness lived, they were terribly weakened by their ordeal. The siege was just over a month old when Henry's war engineers came up with a diabolical invention. An incendiary round for a very large cannon the troops called London. It was a modified cannonball filled with combustibles designed to set the area it impacted on fire.
After only a few volleys, a gateway to the town and the nearby walls were set ablaze. The inferno lasted 2 days. The English had vastly underestimated this new technology's potency. With the outer wall breached, the garrison and townsfolk of Harfleur retreated to a heavily fortified second wall that protected the center of the town. Yet with no sign of any help coming, they had lost heart. King Henry sent a message to them.
"I am your rightful king, and I have no wish to commit further harm."
He offered them generous terms for their surrender, and they accepted. All the French noblemen and knights swore to report to Calais in November, where they were to be ransomed back to their families. Then the garrison was allowed to leave unmolested, and the population was allowed to stay or go if they chose. True to their word, every man who swore arrived at Calais as promised. After seizing the town, Henry gave his army 8 days to rest and recuperate. Many had died in the intense fighting, many more from the bloody flux. The fleet was used to ferry home any too sick or wounded to continue fighting. Henry would have been doing some calculating to figure out his next move. The siege had taken 5 weeks, a very respectable amount of time for a fortified and vigorously defended town to fall. Yet he had hoped for it to fall in 2 to 3 weeks at the most. The disease had cost the army dearly in suffering and lives. With the 1,500 men he would have to leave to garrison Harfleur, minus the dead and wounded, the sum total of fighting men he had available was 5,000 archers and 900 men-at-arms. 5,900 men was not enough to march on Paris. He called a war council where their options were discussed. The commanders of his army wanted to take ship for home from Harfleur. The capture of a single town, even one as strategically important, would be seen as a failure by Parliament given the ruinous cost of the military expedition. If they went home directly from Harfleur, there was a good chance that Parliament would never vote to fund another war for Henry again. He decided that the army would march to Calais, the other English-held port, symbolically at least, claiming the land as his own. But first, he challenged his cousin, the Dauphin, to trial by ordeal for the French throne. That's judicial combat, a duel. Contrary to popular belief, most single combat was not to the death. This was different. Judicial combat in chivalric France meant you were asking God to speak through your weapon to vanquish your foe. And though the duel was not necessarily lethal, the result was binding. The match would be sanctioned by the church, blessed by a priest, and witnessed by many. Henry was a skilled warrior who had taken a longbow arrow to the face at 16 and returned to the battlefield. The Dauphin was so corpulent that he was most famous for getting winded when walking between brothels. Thus, if the pudgy Prince of Paris accepted, Henry would kill him and become heir to the French throne. Always one to disappoint his own people, the Dauphin kept Henry's messenger waiting for days, ignoring the channel, which was a grave dishonor. This was made infinitely more insulting when it became clear that he would send no reply. He was of the blood royal. His honor was France's honor. With the honor of France at stake, knights poured into Marshal Boucicault's camp from all over France, and the size of his army swelled immensely. I'm more than a little suspicious that Henry knew that his bloated cousin would refuse, and that honor would demand that all knights that heard of the challenge would ride to defend the honor of France. Much like the incendiary round for his cannon, Henry vastly underestimated the effect. However, he believed God was on his side with every fiber of his being, and his cause was just. Though he only had 5,900 men, most had been in combat together for years fighting in Wales. His army was a well-oiled machine full of professional units of experienced killers, and he was determined to use it.
so he did all he could to provoke the French. Marshal Boucicault would end up in command of 18,000 anointed knights and thousands more support troops. If Henry V wanted a fight, he was going to get one, outnumbered at least 3-1. In order to make best possible speed, Henry left his cannon at Harfleur and ordered his men to carry 8 days of provisions. He wanted to limit the number of slow-moving carts that made a baggage train to essential items like arrows and the royal war chest. In ideal conditions, 8 days would be just enough time for the army to complete the journey to Calais. Marshal Boucicault was not idle during this time. Based near Rouen to the south, he was continually adding bands of knights and trying to incorporate them into a cohesive fighting force. No mean feat, given the fact that many of the nobles outranked him in the social order, and were quick to point out that he came from common stock. Though never to his face, it was only out of respect and a healthy dose of fear of offending the celebrated warrior that he was obeyed at all. By the time his scouts told him that the English army was marching towards Calais, Henry had a 2-day lead. In response, Marshal Boucicault sent bands of knights on fast horses ahead and had them burn and block many bridges. His plan was to drive Henry inland so that his army could catch up and block the road to Calais and safety. After 2 days on the march, it became apparent that many of King Henry's men were still sick from the bloody flux. They were forced to cut holes in their pants and endure the debilitating illness while still marching. The English neither had the supplies nor the option to stop. The risk of being completely surrounded was far too great. Going back to Harfleur was no longer an option either, as riders coming up from the rear informed Henry that the enemy's vanguard was now behind them. It was on the 4th day that it became apparent to Henry that his army was being pushed inland from the destroyed or hopelessly barricaded bridges. And on the far side of the River Seine, his army was being shadowed, constantly paced by bands of French knights, who yelled curses and challenges from across the water. Every day, the number of French knights seen across the river increased, as did reports of massive numbers behind them. All knights, the heaviest cavalry anywhere in the world. If they managed to surround the English on an open plain, Henry's army would be annihilated. He ordered that every man was to cut a 6-foot length of wood and sharpen both ends and carry it with them at all times, thus further adding to the burden of the grueling march. The French numbers were truly shocking and ever-increasing. They were angry, and every knight wanted to complete the chivalric rite of passage of victory on the battlefield against a foreign invader. The truce had lasted 15 years, so many of the knights had never fought the English. Apart from tourneys and border skirmishes against bands of fellow knights, they had never even fought a set-piece battle. They were eager for glory, riches, and respect. In many ways, this was a clash between two ways of life. Feudal France, where rank meant everything, and the more merit-based English contract system, where peasants could fight beside kings. When the French looked at the English archers, they scoffed. The idea that this army of peasants could ever defeat the flower of French chivalry was simply unthinkable. They, of course, knew of the defeats at Crecy and Poitiers, and the role the longbow had played. But the lesson that the French nobility took from those horrific losses was that their forefathers had not been chivalrous enough, thus dooming them to defeat. Marshal Boucicault himself was wary of the longbow and knew how effective it could be. He had gone to the king many years before and brought up the idea of creating their own longbow corps, recruited from the peasantry. In a rare moment of clarity, the mad king endorsed the idea. Yet he was forced to abandon it when threatened by revolt from his vassal lords who refused to allow their peasants to take up arms. A large enough armed peasantry could begin to resist the ridiculous burdens that feudalism placed upon them. They could become a threat to their lords and the entire social order of France. The only way to maintain a system where it took the year-round work of 20 peasants to support one knight was to keep it impossible for those 20 people to resist it. The nobles knew the minute they lost their monopoly on violence, their way of life would cease to exist. As knights regarded the bow as an effete weapon and beneath them, the French hired mercenary crossbowmen for ranged offense. Though skilled at their craft, the Genoese crossbow used at the time took close to a minute to load, aim, and fire. It had 1/3 the range of a longbow, about 100 yards, though it packed a tremendous punch at close range. and the small quarrels could penetrate weak points in armor with ease. As his forces tightened their noose around the English, Marshal Boucicault formulated a battle plan. Once ahead of them, the main French army would block the road and wait. In medieval strategy, the advantage always went to the side that was defending. In other words, the English would be desperate and have to attack. His plan was to wait for Henry's army to advance to the most effective longbow range, about 200 yards. Once this happened, the men-at-arms, knights on foot, would advance and give cover to the crossbowmen who would be interspersed among these advancing knights. They would use the plate-covered warriors as shields against the arrows, and at 100 yards, the Genoese crossbowmen would open fire at Henry's relatively few number of foot soldiers. With the English archers' attention on the advancing army in front of them, Marshal Boucicault would send in his multitudes of heavy cavalry to attack the flanks and surround the English. This plan was not without merit and could work, but it would require discipline and close coordination among what had become a colossal mob of decidedly individualist individuals. It was 10 days into the march, and the English army was beginning to starve. The burnt bridges had forced them far off course. Henry was forced to send out foraging parties and demand food from any settlement they came across. They mainly subsisted on scraps of dried meat and walnuts, which were abundant in the woods. Henry enforced what for the Middle Ages was iron discipline. He regarded the peasants that he came across as his subjects. If they did not give supplies out of respect or fear, they were left unmolested. He tolerated absolutely no theft, rape, or unnecessary violence on the march. The same could not be said for the bands of French knights. With the ongoing dysentery and malnutrition, it was a severely weakened and demoralized army that approached the village of Agincourt. After 17 days on the march, it was the afternoon of the 24th of October, 1415, when Henry's scouts returned with dire news. The road ahead was blocked by a huge French army, far larger than anything Henry had ever dreamed of facing. There were 18,000 knights and 2,000 crossbowmen, with some other support troops, pages, squires, and thousands of camp followers, which would include crafts and tradesmen of every kind, wine and food merchants, and the staple of undisciplined army since the beginning of time, a small army of sex workers. There was much money to be made catering to the needs and desires of knights and noblemen. As the English approached, it would have sounded like they were nearing a huge country fair with music and laughter. The French army was in full celebration. They had won the race and trapped the English. They would have seen beautifully embroidered tents with pennants fluttering in the wind. There were thousands of bright banners and all the battle standards of the chivalry of France. And above them all, the Oriflamme, its gold thread sunburst glittering in the light. Every Englishman knew that meant there would be no quarter given, and the French had come for their blood. And why not celebrate? There was just the small matter of the disheveled army of filthy peasants to slaughter in the morning, and eternal glory and wealth would be theirs. After all, how could this glorious gathering of the greatest warriors France had ever produced be stopped? Unthinkable. Henry's army closed to about 1,000 yards and ordered that camp be made. They had no glorious tents and pavilions. For most of the men, it meant finding some wood for a fire and sleeping on the ground, exposed to the elements. As the sun was about to set, Henry ensured guards were posted, and he proceeded to study the battlefield as long as the dimming light allowed. He then moved from campfire to campfire and spoke to his men, giving them encouragement and doing what he could to lift their spirits. Though they all had suffered, they still loved their king. At midnight, a steady rain began to fall. Still making his way around the camp, Henry noticed something. The ground was quickly turning into very sticky mud. The more he moved, the more mud clung to his boots, making each step heavier and harder. The soil at Agincourt, and indeed this entire part of France, is very porous, meaning it can absorb and hold an unusual amount of water. If you held some in your hand and added just a little water, it would become thick and very sticky. As the night progressed and the rain continued, the field in front of Henry was turning into a hidden quagmire as the soil greedily absorbed the constant drizzle. With the last of the revels in the French camp dying down in the early morning hours, I imagine that Henry V cracked a knowing smile as he thanked God in a quick prayer for this unforeseen gift. Traditionally, the battlefield at Agincourt was thought to be a rectangle. However, recent studies of the site show something quite different. It was quite wide where the French were and got steadily more narrow as you approached the English. On either side of the ever-narrowing field, there was a short, steep drop into nearly impassable thickets of trees. Even under ideal circumstances, pushing a large number of men and horses down a narrow path creates problems, and conditions at Agincourt were far from ideal. With dawn fast approaching, it was do or die, all or nothing for Henry V and his starving army. So it was that on October 25th, 1415 Common Era, the Battle of Agincourt unfolded thusly. At dawn, Marshal Boucicault formed his huge army into three groups. On both flanks were narrow but very deep ranks of heavy cavalry. The center was formed by thousands upon thousands of men-at-arms, with crossbowmen intermixed in the forward lines. The fact that Marshal Boucicault got this many unruly, entitled, and headstrong knights into cohesive lines is something of a minor miracle, and a credit to the force of his personality. He gave orders to his army to wait where they were, for the English to attack in force, and then the infantry was to advance. Once their men-at-arms had engaged a relatively small number of their English counterparts and had the full attention of the English archers, horns would blare, signaling the charge to be sounded, and the French heavy cavalry would race across the field, an unstoppable force of plate-covered men and horse, who would utterly smash the English archers on the wings. Across the fields, the hungry and freezing English troops stood looking at the glorious and well-fed French in their gleaming armor. The rain had stopped at dawn, and there was a faint mist rising from the ground as the sun periodically broke through the clouds. While the French had been ponderously forming their lines, Henry had advanced his army until it was 500 yards from the enemy. He placed his 900 men-at-arms in the center and had his archers in a horseshoe formation around them. Now remember the stakes that Henry had each man cut? 6 feet long and sharpened on both sides? He had his men hammer them into the ground with their points facing the French army. Very thick rows protecting the archers on the flanks, and very few protecting the center. He had reserved a small force to protect the war chest and what few supplies remained to them in the rear. With his battle line set, Henry allowed his men to throw curses at the French army, hoping to get them to charge. The English threw every insult imaginable at them, and the French knights must have bristled at the affront to their honor, but they held their positions. After 3 hours of standing there, it was placed atop his armored head, and he took his place in the front line in the center of his army. Every French knight now saw that the greatest windfall in honor, wealth, and glory was standing right there. Any man who killed or captured Henry V would be rich and famous beyond imagining. They must have been itching to charge across the field, yet they held firm. It is a testament to how much fear and respect that Boucicault commanded that even with the equivalent of a medieval billion-dollar lottery ticket standing there, his men maintained their order. Surely frustrated and getting desperate because the English army needed to fight that day while they were still strong enough to do so, Henry dispatched approximately 80 of his best archers forward to maximum longbow range, about 300 yards, and ordered them to fire at the cavalry on the wings. The drizzle of arrows must have seemed a pathetic ploy and was largely ignored until they began to find gaps in the horses' armor and actually shot a few dead under their riders. The first ranks of French knights and their mounts, maddened by the scent of horse blood, had taken all they would from these peasants. And before Boucicault's yells for the fools to stop could be heard, the bulk of his cavalry had begun to follow them across the field. The English archers ran back to their lines. Henry watched as the first ranks of knights closed the distance, all of their lances seemingly pointed at his gleaming crown. At 200 yards, he gave the order, and 5,000 bowstrings were pulled back, arrows knocked, aimed, and loosed.
Cocktail!
Thrum. Knock. Draw. Loose. Thrum. 10 seconds later. Thrum. As he had known the night before, the first horses had already slowed from a gallop to a trot because of the mud and were getting slower when the first 5,000 arrows hit the unruly line. Decimation. Riders and horses became living pincushions. The bodkin points of the arrows did exactly what they were designed to do, penetrate plate armor. The riders behind would find their mounts tripping over the fallen knights and horses that only seconds before had been charging towards eternal glory. Even those knights that didn't lose their seats to the dead obstacles in their path were themselves pin-cushioned with arrows 10 seconds later. The wounds inflicted beyond causing grievous harm and death had a secondary effect. Hundreds of gallons of blood were being soaked up by the soil, and it was becoming more like quicksand than mere muddy ground. From Marshal Boucicault's vantage atop his mighty warhorse, he would have seen the impossible rhythmic rising and falling of 5,000 arrows at a time, and witnessed what their French forefathers had called an arrow storm. Though there had never been one like this, with so many arrows falling so consistently at such a fast rate, concentrated in such a small area, he wouldn't have been able to see the utter decimation the rain of arrows was making of the front ranks of his cavalry. He did know that if he could get his crossbowmen in range, they could give the English an arrow storm of their own. So he ordered his center to advance with a blast from his page's war horn. The deep and numerous center advanced. Within minutes of that initial wild charge, hundreds of men and horses were dead and dying in the mud, their fluids adding to what was quickly becoming a quagmire. The few that did nearly make it to where Henry stood didn't last long, as the archers in Henry's personal guard shot them at point-blank range. All the while, new deadly clouds were rising and falling. Let's do some quick math. 6 arrows a minute is 360 per hour per archer. With 5,000 archers, that means the combined hourly rate of fire for Henry's army was 1.8 million arrows per hour. Arrow storm. A name so apt, I need say no more. The French center on foot was having an incredibly slow advance. The porous and very sticky mud was creating a suction effect on their smooth plate armor. Every step was more difficult to take than the last. The lightly armored crossbowmen fared far better in the mud, but were cut down by the score by each wave of arrows. Hundreds of knights who could not lift their legs to step forward in the quagmire were pushed by the weight of men behind them and fell chest first into the mud. Once down, no one could get up. The suction that the mud created made it impossible to stand. Hundreds slowly suffocated as they sunk into the mud, only to be used as stepstones for their advancing brothers in arms. Eventually, the ranks of the French center did reach the English line. They were exhausted, with many arrows protruding from their armor. Filled with rage, covered with bloody mud, they crashed into the English center. Though the English did have some noblemen and more than a few knights of their own, it was largely plate-armored French knights versus English men-at-arms who were mostly commoners clad in chainmail. Though hungry and tired, they were fresh, and the English fought savagely. The knights were getting the worst of it by far, and many could barely lift their arms because of exhaustion and the weight of all the mud that covered them. Many more surrendered upon reaching the front. Henry had these men taken to the rear, though he could ill afford the men required to guard them. Within just an hour, Henry had 1,200 humiliated prisoners in the rear, guarded by a skeletal force. Yet no matter how many they slew, the French kept coming. Marshal Boucicault, not knowing exactly what was happening at the front, and under extreme pressure from the nobles in his remaining cavalry wing, allowed them to advance. He had no choice. It was a matter of honor for them to go to the aid of their countrymen. Resigned, he decided to lead the charge himself. Chaos ensued. The field was bloody quicksand. In places, man and horse would simply sink and become stuck. The added pressure of being pushed from behind forced hundreds more to fall and be pushed down into the depths of the mud. The arrow storm continued, but not for much longer. The English were running out of arrows, and the pressure on the front line had pushed it to its breaking point. Henry and his guard were under a constant attack, just as he had planned. He put himself out there as bait, and they came for him by the thousands. At one point, Henry was surrounded by five knights. One cut a part of his crown off and badly dented his helm. He was saved by a band of archers, now out of arrows, wielding clubs and daggers. These filthy peasants, as the French derisively called them, turned out to be excellent killers. Under normal circumstances, the idea that an English archer could fight a French knight in hand-to-hand combat was laughable at best. At Agincourt, however, the knights they fought were exhausted and weighed down. Their movements were sloppy and slow. It proved easy for the nimble and unencumbered archers to avoid their clumsy blows and find gaps in their armor to slide their daggers into. In many cases, they simply walked up to a knight stuck up to his waist in the mud and dispatched a man who had trained for war since boyhood with a rusted dagger. It was a slaughter on a scale no one there had ever seen before. Other archers ran out to collect arrows from the slain and returned them to the ranks behind to be fired again. 2 hours into the fighting, Marshal Boucicault reached the front line. His horse had died by arrow 100 yards behind. Covered in mud and utterly demoralized, he surrendered to King Henry himself. At this precise moment, a column of French knights appeared in the English rear. They were a contingent from Burgundy and were latecomers to join the army. Not knowing what had occurred on the battlefield, and eager for ransoms and glory, they charged the baggage train that contained Henry's war chest and much of the wealth of England. He was forced to make a decision that would mar his name forever in the annals of French chivalry. In order to defend his rear, the only troops that weren't engaged in heavy fighting were the ones guarding his several thousand noble prisoners. Fearing that these prisoners would rise up and join the last-ditch attack on the rear, he ordered the guards to kill them all and then go support the rear. To help them do so quickly, he dispatched 500 arrowless archers to help. It was a grisly business. More than 2,000 prisoners were executed by blade or set on fire to burn to death, a shocking violation of the chivalric code. This brutal decision did prove wise, and once reinforced, his rearguard repulsed the charge of French knights. The battle was over. The Oriflamme, the symbol of French resolve and nationality, lay trodden into the mud, never to be found. The flower of French chivalry lay dead on that field near the village of Agincourt. Against seemingly impossible odds, a new way of warfare had triumphed over an old one. From now on, contract armies of professional soldiers from all classes would become the norm. Henry V returned to London and celebrated a virtual triumph. Within 5 years, after more successful campaigns against a completely demoralized France, he was named heir to the French throne. Though he died, oddly enough from dysentery, at the age of 36, and never got to ascend to his birthright, Henry V was forever after the standard to which all English kings were held. France had lost so much of its nobility and ruling class in the battle that its self-image was decimated. It took many years and a young peasant girl who heard voices from heaven to rekindle a sense of national pride. Thank you for listening to Deep Into History. I hope you enjoyed
The Day Chivalry Died.
Please tell everyone you know about this show and leave a review wherever you listen. You can follow me at Deep Into History on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky, and Threads to get your daily blast from the past. And as always, my dear friend, take care of yourself. I truly look forward to the next time we go deep.
How deep do you want to go?